Hi, I'm Shanna Bennett, and you're listening to Matter of Life and Debt. To start off our very first episode of 2023, we have Nick Marcil, an organizer with the Debt Collective, and we have members of the Debt Collective's 50 over 50 strikers. So let's learn more about the strikers and understand why it's important to center people over the age of, 18 in this national conversation about student debt. Nick, Susan, David, Laura, welcome to the podcast. Hey, everybody. Hi.
Thank you.
Good night.
Hi. Hello. Woo.
So to be fully open with our listeners, we've actually had this conversation before. This is like deja vu for some of us right now, because we've had this conversation before. We've had some technical difficulties. We had to come back, sit down, have the conversation again. So it's an even better opportunity to kind of get some of our thoughts across and to kind of hang out a bit again. So I'm going to start with you, Nick. Let's talk about these 50 over 50 strikers and how this idea came to be over at the Debt Collective.
Thank you very much for having me again. My name is Nick Marcil. I'm an organizer with the Debt Collective. I'm happy to be here and happy to have such amazing folks here on this podcast. Yeah, I mean, with like the 50 over 50 debt strike, as I'll say, a lot of people, as you even sort of mentioned to an extent of like, they think that the student debt crisis is only for folks who are maybe just coming out of college, like folks who are in their like 20s, like myself, yeah. Right? And that it's not something that like actually affects people of all ages, and also has a lot of people who are actually, yeah, like maybe over the age of 50 or maybe even older than that. And right. It's really trying to break apart and break down some of those time and time again narratives that you hear that, oh, it's just like these young people with student debt, that they're going to Starbucks too much, or like whatever BS stuff that it is. Right. And realistically, there are so many stories out there of folks who are maybe over the age of 50 and still have this debt. And that really kind of helps to showcase another side, or even just a larger scope and picture of the student debt crisis, and really why we need to right here, right now, get it all canceled. That's right. You know, come on.
Right. I think the idea that is being, what is it, perpetrated or spread, the idea is that, just to kind of piggyback on your thought, is that the folks that are struggling with student debt are young and quote unquote immature and irresponsible. And I think that only goes to discredit some of our arguments that there is an issue here and it is predatory. And there are people over the, actually a growing number of student debt borrowers are over the age of 30. And it's a worthwhile conversation. So I'm really glad that the Debt Collective had this idea to do this 50 over 50 strike. Can you give us a window into what the striking consists of, and what's the importance of striking?
Yeah. So again, like with this 50 over 50 strike, we have seen it grow. I keep sometimes referring it to as 50 over 50 because originally we started out just like 50 folks and now we have a couple hundred. So it's really awesome to sort of see that over time. And then again, of like with this strike, this is sort of like one part of our larger student debt strike. And really it's trying to get folks to understand that there are options to strike, to basically say that like, no, I'm not paying a cent of this back. Like whether it is folks who are able to get down to as low as $0 per month payments with like income driven repayment or such, those who are able to maybe file for borrower defense, potentially those who have maybe even gone back to school or those who are still in school kind of stuff, and other sort of ways in where we can make sure that folks can safely strike. There are also folks who are willing and want to default, and that's also awesome too, if you really want to make those stands, but also reiterating for folks that we want to make sure that folks can safely strike, because there are definitely its own ways in where it can impact you, right? Like that's the whole part of this student debt crisis, of like the impact that this debt has on you financially or mentally, and not just even to you, but to your family. And it's really kind of showcasing those things and getting folks to come together, as we will like typically have of like a student desk strike info session. I'm sure that we'll have something like that coming up again to toss out some more information. But yeah.
And the Debt Collective has also seen success with using striking as a means of protest, a means of getting media attention, a means of pushing forward certain ideas. And I believe that it's through striking that the Debt Collective was able to get student debt cancellation for individuals that attended for-profit schools, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So we definitely have had like success in this in the past, as you're mentioning, right? So of folks who were like the Corinthian strikers, and they went to this for-profit colleges and stuff like within like Corinthian, that's like the name that everyone knows. And of getting just some folks together to basically say like, no, I'm not paying this back because this is ridiculous. This for-profit school like literally like scammed me into thinking that I'm going to be guaranteed a job out of this, or I'm going to get an education that I want for me, et cetera, et cetera. And folks who were able to come together to strike and to say like, no. And that really has, that paved the way for instance, one of the methods of currently striking, of borrower defense. That's what has gotten us, I would say, to an extent, to the point of with news on like the Sweet settlement, when folks who are getting their debt canceled right here and now. And it's awesome to see that. And really with the striking, we want to continue that momentum and making sure that all of this debt is canceled, because we shouldn't be worrying about students. We shouldn't be worrying about medical debt. We shouldn't be worrying about school lunch debt, or so on and so forth. Like these things. No.
So if you're at home and you're wondering, are we talking about pitchforks in the street in terms of striking? Well, protesting to a certain extent, yes. But we're talking about actually just refusing to pay. And what Nick is saying, there is a strategy to doing that if you're interested in learning more about that. And I'm sure we'll have information on the website for that as well. Laura, let's start with you. Tell me a little bit about what the strike means to you and how you got connected with the Debt Collective.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Yes, the Debt Collective means solidarity. It means that I've met people or I've seen people through our Slack that are in similar circumstances as I am, and I felt alone for a very long time. My student loan debt goes back to 1986 when I was an undergraduate, and I took out the student loans. When I graduated and started working in the 90s, the early 90s, I had to consolidate my student loans because I was finding it difficult with my salary to be able to pay my living expenses and the debt at the same time. And the only option I saw was Sallie Mae. I didn't know there were any programs available, like the William D. Ford program, I think was actually available then, but it wasn't made known to people. I consolidated my loans with Sallie Mae. I had about $16,000 worth of student loans, and I intended to pay them back. I didn't have a problem paying them back because I benefited. I got my degree. But when I went to go back to grad school, which I had always intended on doing, I discovered that my student loans were still, they were accruing. Well, when the quarterly capitalization of interest letter came out to me, I thought, what the heck? I thought my student loans, my government student loans, were subsidized. I called up, and apparently I was told by someone at Sallie Mae that the student loan consolidation in this window of time that I consolidated my student loans in 1992, they weren't covered. And so the government subsidization was taken away. This didn't sound right to me. It was my first indication that there was something wrong with this consolidation, which I thought was my only option. And only after a long time of dealing with this, and as many people have said, it definitely affects your life choices, your social life, you know, my credit. It affected all the decisions I made. I ended up leaving grad school because I thought, I'm not going to spend any more. I'm not going to give them any more money. I'm not going to be taking out any more of these student loans, because I realized that they were just making money off of me. And it was very disappointing. I became very disillusioned in the whole system. I also happened to be in urban planning at the time, and I realize that all these great, wonderful plans that we want to create for our communities don't really happen unless you have economic backing. And I wrote a paper, and in it I realized that without resources and the finances to fund things that we want to change the world we live in, we can make a difference by our choices, by our financial choices, the things that we put our energy and our money into. And so with that, I just left school and I became one of the people who was unsuccessful and, you know, considered unsuccessful. And I ended up not paying off my student loans. They ended up accruing a lot of interest because they were initially at 8 to 9%. And so I, to date, have not been able to pay them off. I've gone through default. I tried to claim bankruptcy. And because they were FFEL loans, the Illinois Student Assistance Commission attorney came to the deposition and really attacked me personally in that bankruptcy. And it's been a real, it creates a lot of, because it's such a long time, it's been now 30 years, it's created a lot of negative energy, which I try to stay away from. And this debt collective has been very helpful, but at the same time, I have to keep a distance. I want to make a change. Every time something has come up, like back with Clinton, he offered the Teach for America. I thought, oh, that's a great program. And I, you know, tried to participate in that, and it didn't happen to work out. I actually did AmeriCorps for a while, but the amount of the money that they were providing after the program is just like a drop in the bucket for my debt at this point, or at that point. My debt now currently is $109,000, and that is based on a principal of $16,000 for undergraduate and $8,000 for graduate school. And I just think it's unfair. Yes, the economy, there's losers and winners in the economy, and it's people are making money off of us. And that's the most disappointing part is why does, you know, we live in a capitalist society. We understand that a lot of people tell us we're better off for that. But I really don't think a society that cannibalizes its people is a successful society. And I will continue to fight this, and I'm here to be part of the collective in any way I can. I tried to write President Biden a letter back when he was asking for letters, but every time I went to write it, it really sucks a lot of energy out of me. But I finally, by being with the debt collective and seeing other people and feeling more supportive, I was able to finish that kind of letter, and it was very cathartic because you get it out and now I can just put it aside and it's not eating at me any longer, you know. And so I think this is a great group for supporting, especially those 50 over 50, because, you know, we want to be part of this too. We've been part of it all along. We just didn't have, back in the 90s or even early 2000s, there really wasn't the resources that there are now, right? We have great resources. Podcasts are easier to create, and we can all connect with the internet and Facebook and all that. And we want to remain relevant because we're still fighting. We're still here, even though we're over 50.
I think the one thing I would like to repeat is your phrase, a society that cannibalizes its citizens is not a successful society. Especially the citizens that are trying and striving to get an education. You didn't buy a lot of shoes. You didn't buy a lot of designer bags or a fancy dress or something. I don't know. You tried to get an education. And 16,000 undergrad, 8,000 grad has turned into $109,000. That's outrageous.
Yeah, I just think, you know, and society needs us to educate ourselves, right?
Right.
And especially people talking about arts. I ended up getting my degree in art.
Nice.
Actually, I went back to school to get back into my original degree, which was architecture. But we need artists. A lot of people are talking about, I'm not going to pay for somebody to get a degree in art or basket weaving, but you know what? All right. We need artists in our society as well. And thank you again.
I think Nick had a comment. What you got, Nick?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to echo on that point of education isn't just job training, or it isn't just something that should be this kind of return on investment type thing. It really should be something that's liberatory. It really should be something in where we should be fighting back against the terrible words of Ronald Reagan of, I do not want to subsidize intellectual curiosity. Yep. He said that, kind of ridiculous, I would say absurd stuff. And really, we should be understanding that everyone deserves an education. We at least kind of understand that as a society at the K-12 level. There are certainly huge disparities when it comes to that. But we at least kind of are okay, any kid go to a public school K-12, yep, you do that. And then when it comes to higher education, we say, well, it's only for you if you have the money, or if you're willing to go into debt, or if you're willing to take all the time and energy in the world to do X, Y, and Z to get whatever scholarships, financial aid, and even then you'll probably end up in debt, like myself, or even I did AmeriCorps for a summer. these things that people say are oh yeah, you'll be fine. It's no, you'll still end up in debt, because this is the way that we have built our society, to the phrase that you had said, Laura, of the just cannibalizing. It shouldn't be that way. And we shouldn't treat education this way.
I agree. And I think it ends up turning into this thing of which degrees is more valuable, which subject matter is more valuable. And it's just not okay, because they're all valuable. And we should all have the luxury of going and studying whatever the heck it is. If it's French literature, if it's Egyptian history, they're all valid and they're all important. Dave, let's turn our attention to you. Tell us a little bit about your story and why the strike is important to you.
Hi, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I am Dave. I'm 64, and I am deep into the student debt. And you would think that wouldn't be possible. But my story is my youngest son, from when he was very little, wanted to go to this particular Ivy League college. He had been discussing this since he was able to talk, about 3 or 4 years old. And he talked about it through grade school, through junior high, and through high school. And his grades were okay in high school. They weren't terrific, but they were good, but certainly not good enough to get into this Ivy League college. So we knew that. So his mother and I didn't really think that was going to be a big deal. So sure enough, senior year, he goes to apply for colleges, and he has to apply for this particular high-grade Ivy League college that we knew he wasn't going to get into, but we humored him because we love him, and go for it, kid. So he went for it, and they responded and said, you do not have grades good enough, but we will entertain if you want to write us an essay. And he's a good writer, and he was passionate about this since about the age of 3. So you know what? He wrote this Academy Award-winning 20-page essay on how he wanted to go to this college since he was little, and by the grace of God, he got accepted. So his mother and I were kind of freaking out because we knew we couldn't afford it, and we didn't have any money for this, but whatever, and we weren't going to tell him after years of wanting to do this that he couldn't go. So we did what was offered, what was called the Wondrous Parents Plus Loan, which is where the parents assume all the debt and the kids scot-free. And we signed up for the loan, and we were divorced at the time. So the deal was my ex-wife was going to take the first 2 years of college, and I was going to take the second 2 years. That was the deal. Fast forward, he graduates, and we start making payments. And it was fine. The payments are high, but we knew we were going to pay it. It's okay. And I've worked in hospitals for 34 years, and due to the COVID pandemic, I got let go in January of 2020 after 34 years. So I've been unemployed since then and living off Social Security. So I cannot make the payment. So I tried to get into what is affectionately called the income-driven repayment program, which is a joke. I talked to my lender several times, and the answer was resoundingly no. Not we will work with you, not we will discuss it with you, not we will entertain the possibility. It was no every time. Okay, then we get into the pause, and now we're in the pause, and here we are. So, okay, so how does that affect me? So I'm not making the payment right now, which is great, but I live on Social Security, which is $20-something thousand a year. Great. And my credit score is over 800. But because my debt to income ratio is so low, my debt is so high and my income is so low, I cannot qualify for any loans. Cannot get a new car, cannot get a car loan, cannot buy a condo if I want. So I'm 64. I live in an apartment by myself and it's like prison. And I'm going to live like this till the day I die and the debt's going to die with me. So I'm not advocating that I be released from the debt. Listen, I signed up for it. I knew what I was getting into. And me and my ex-wife agreed that this was what it was. We're okay with it. But income drip, if you want to reduce my payments to something I can afford, fine. When the payments do resume, if I make the payment, I will not be able to pay my rent or I will not be able to eat. And you know what? No offense, but I'm not really willing to give up either. You know, so, and I don't have any other, I don't have any other debt. I don't have any credit card bills, like you guys said, and I certainly don't have an expensive dress in the closet, like you had said before. So I don't. So this is where I'm at. So the bad part is I'm saddled with this debt. I can't continue the quality of my life. And you know what the really worst part about that is? I didn't even get to go to the college. So I'm saddled with this debt, and I didn't have the benefit of the education myself. So I'm not going to stick my newly graduated son with it, who's now in public service and making next to nothing. I'm not going to saddle him with the debt. So my options are, I get on an income-driven repayment program if somebody is willing to give that to me.
Yeah.
The debt dies with me, and the world will have to live with that. We have the lawsuit going on through the Supreme Court, and nobody knows where that's going to go. And our illustrious president today announced these other initiatives for income-driven repayment program. And about 4 or 5 o'clock this evening, they admitted, oh, that doesn't include the Parents Plus people. So regardless of whatever occurs, I'm not going to see any relief at all. So like I said, given the option of eating or paying my debt, or given the option of paying my rent and not getting evicted or paying my debt, my choice is clear. So, and my lender will have to understand that, and that's where I'm at. So I appreciate you listening to my story.
Wow. So I remember Nikki and I, quick interlude. Okay. Quick story. So I actually met Nikki because she interviewed me like we're doing now for the podcast. And in knowing her, there was somebody that either maybe she interviewed or we've spoken to in the past who actually talked about the effects of student debt on the family and on the family structure and how it can affect dynamics. Is that something that you experienced, Dave, taking on the student debt in the way that you did?
Well, I don't involve my youngest son in this. He's transparent to everything that's going on because he's young and fresh out of college and he loves his girl and they're going to get married next year. And he's saddled with his own drama. He works for a county and he makes 20-something thousand a year and he can't afford the debt anyway. So the last thing I'm going to do is call him and say, oh, by the way, son, you owe the 6-figure debt for college. The deal was his mother and I would assume the debt. That was the deal. And I'm okay with that. Like I said, I don't advocate that anybody eliminates my debt at all. I signed up for it, and I'm a man of my word, and I'm totally okay with that. But give me a payment that I can live with and not sacrifice my quality of life. That's all I'm asking.
Right. And then what about the expense of it? So you agree that you're saying that you took on the debt. You're saying it's your responsibility. No. Do you agree with the cost of it? Because that's the part that I struggle
with. No. I think... No, but right. At that time, the option was either to get this Parent Plus loan or right. To sit down and look at my 18-year-old son and say this dream he had was going to die today.
Right.
And we weren't willing to do that. So you talk about family dynamics. So for right. The sake of our family, that was the decision that we made. So that right. Was it. So, and he has the benefit of the education and his life is going to be okay. And he's not saddled with the debt. Quite frankly, I'm okay with that. And if it's a choice of me taking on a burden or putting the burden on my own children as a parent, I'll take on the burden. I'm okay with
right.
That.
And I know, I think I was in a similar situation looking back as an immigrant kid, immigrant family. I don't think anyone wanted to crush my dreams and say, hey, we can't afford this. If anything, it was the opposite. It was, you're going to go do this. Who cares what it costs? We're going to make this happen. And it's not until years later, I kind of wished somebody brought up the cost. You know,
to sign a piece of paper and allow my child to have his dream, I'll tell you, cost was the last thing on our mind. We knew it was going to be 4 years from now and we wouldn't have to deal with it. And she was making a bunch of money and I was making a boatload of money in the hospital before I got laid off. All gone. Hospital offered me no 401k, no pension. So I got zip after 34 years. So thank you very much, healthcare. But that's the world, too. So, you know, okay. It is what it is.
I know. It's wild. And I thought I'd graduate, immediately make six figures, and I'd be able to pay off my debt. Like, that's how I thought the story was going to go, without realizing that there's an entry-level salary. You don't just, well, for some degrees, I should say, you don't just start out making six figures. Hang on, Nick, didn't you have a comment? You had a comment, didn't you?
I was just going to add to, like, of what Dave said of, like, the burden. Like, neither you nor your son nor your family, like, should feel that, like, burden. Right. Like, it's not necessarily even like of the choice of, yes, I'm willing to do this, sign on the dotted line. Right. But why did you have to even sign on the dotted line in the first place?
Right.
And like, when it comes into the, oh, my kids and or their parents or whatever should be educated on these things. It's like, okay, right. But like, you're only saying that to folks who don't have the financial resources to get there in the first place. So then you're going to say, well, then you're going to have to go into debt. Then you're going to have however much a month that you're going to have to pay afterwards. And then who knows if you lose a job, if your parents lose a job, if rent goes up, if, you know, X, Y, or Z, you're still on the hook. Mm-hmm. That should not be the case. And it's the continual fight of like, yeah, this cancellation of free public higher education, you know, of these things to like make sure that we don't come back again and again to this situation that just continues to spiral that is this crisis.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, we should be applauding this kid that was passionate from the age of 3 or 4 to go to this higher education institution, who then was able to whip together this 20 something page essay about why he deserved to be there and then got in. Like, that's supposed to be the American dream. Do you know what I mean? Work your butt off and then get somewhere.
The last thing we were going to do as parents was to crush his dream. We would have pretty much done anything at that point. And the Parents Plus loan was the easy way out. It was the world's way of saying, he can have his dream and you guys will pay for it and everything will be rosy.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And I don't know why the Parent Plus loans are treated differently. They're continually treated differently than other federally backed loans. I don't know what that's about. Yes, they're parents, but it's still a loan for higher education. I don't know why they're not.
I think maybe the government feels it's okay to ruin our lives more than it is to ruin some young passionate kid. So they're okay with that. We understand the student debt crisis and we want to help these young kids and all that stuff, but their parents, screw them. They signed up for it and they're stuck for it and whatever.
Yeah. And then we see Social Security checks being garnished because of student loans. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, Susan. Tell us a little bit about what the strike means to you and kind of where you are currently with your student debt.
So what the strike means to me, I think I can say something similar as Laura and Dave, just the solidarity, the knowing that you're not alone and you're not alone. And knowing that there are more people that share such similar stories. I mean, my dad is almost as old as Laura's. Between, I guess, the oldest loan is 33 years old, and I graduated in 1994 with, I don't even know how much, I don't know what the total was, but it couldn't have been, just based on what I was getting every year, it couldn't have been more than 30. I've paid that back in between the years of like 2010 and 2017, I paid that back between like $32,000 and $35,000. But that was after going into default in the 90s. That was after like ignoring them in my 20s. And it wasn't because I was irresponsible. It was because I was a teacher and I wasn't making any money. And I wasn't really making enough to really pay attention. So I just let them go into default. And I'm going to be very honest, like, I didn't care about them between the ages of 21 and 35. I didn't care about them. I didn't care what happened to them. I didn't care about my credit score. I didn't care about owning a home because I was just working. I was just working, and I accepted that I was always going to be making between 25 and 35 a year my entire life. I accepted that I was never going to own anything. I was never going to have a credit card, never going to have a car. But I just accepted those things. And then I left education because I was tired of basically being poor and being like 35 and having like nothing to show for anything, and like working at a very, very wealthy school, high school, where like everyone was married, everyone had a mortgage, everyone had kids, and I had nothing. And so basically I just left education. I left the classroom. I decided that I wasn't going to teach anymore. And I moved to Colorado, where I am now. And I started basically working in higher ed admin. And I was, you know, a secretary, essentially, until I was able to, because I was working at a public university, I was able to get my master's degree for free. So I did that at 45 and got it at, I don't know, I guess 40. Well, I don't know. It took me 5 years. I got it 3 years ago. So yeah, I finished at like 40, 46. I'm sorry, 40. How old am I? I just turned 50. I got it at 47. So I started it at like 42. It took me 5 years going part-time, taking like one class a semester for five freaking years, but I didn't have to pay for it. And that was the only way that I could have ever gotten a master's degree. And speaking of like low-paying jobs and being like a secretary, I never made more than $40,000 until I was well into my 40s. And just like knowing that the only way to get out of that situation was more education. And I have other friends who like also came to that realization, like, if I'm ever going to make more than $30,000 a year in my 40s, I'm going to have to get another degree. And I took the route of being in public service and working at the same public service institution for 14 years in order to achieve that. But my friends couldn't do that. They had to actually take on more debt in their 30s and in their 40s. And now they have six-figure debt and they're trying to get out of that. So honestly, like, even though I have $96,000, like, I still feel like, and even though I've paid my original debt, I still feel somewhat fortunate because I was able to get another degree for free. I've applied to public service loan forgiveness. That's its own saga that we're all aware of. And I'm waiting to get that sorted out. I'm waiting for them to find 60 payments that they lost, track of. I'm working with the servicer who was assigned to that project, who is suing the Biden administration, which in itself is unethical. Why hand over this process that affects millions and millions of people to an organization that fundamentally is not interested in helping and is actively suing and pursuing in court through legal means the administration that has handed our lives over to them? I mean, it's disgusting. And I feel helpless, but at the same time, this organization, this group of people has given me some hope back, I think. And joining the 50 over 50 debt strike has made me feel empowered to stop paying. I've been in the payment pause for the pandemic for 3 years, but at the end of last year, joining this group, I made the decision to not pay anything else. And it's, you would think that having paid them back, I would say, well, of course I don't owe anything else, but there's that fear of what's going to happen to you if you don't. And so I'm no longer motivated by that fear. I'm no longer driven and enslaved to that fear. And this group and this collective and talking to other people like Laura and Dave and everyone else that I've met along the way, that has given me the courage to just say, and Talia, and to just say, I'm not going to pay another dime. And I'm not. I have no intention of paying another cent until, first of all, until they get my payments that I have made correct. And once they do, they actually owe me money because I've overpaid. I've overpaid the 120 payments that the PSLF require. I've made about 160 payments. So they need to give that back to me. And luckily, again, it's like I'm not really mad at the Biden administration. I'm mad at Republicans And I'm mad at the Supreme Court, and I'm mad at everyone who has tried to block these efforts of just wiping it out of cancellation. But I do have to say that this extra 6 months that were allotted for this year while everything gets worked through the courts, that is a lifeline for me, because I can still continue to work with this unethical servicer who has possession of my record, my so-called payment tracker for PSLF. So, you know, there's positive and negative. There's definitely plenty of blame to go around on all sides. But at the same time, I do still believe that the Biden administration wants to do the right thing. They don't really understand what the right thing is, but they want to do they want to do what they think is right. They still have a long way to go to understanding what the right thing is. But I think that this movement and the participation of people writing letters, petitions, campaigns, and this collective movement is helping them. And we're going to drag them kicking and screaming into doing what's right, I think. In the meantime, I think just gathering, talking, unloading, like Laura said, being just like having all of this, just getting rid of all of this off of your shoulders and like speaking it to others is so helpful and so meaningful. And we just have to keep doing that to keep our energy up, to keep our spirits up while we continue to fight for full cancellation. And thank you for calling out the French literature. That was me. Thanks for calling me out. The French literature major.
Oh, okay. And I didn't even know.
Well,
I love that. Laura, hey, did you have something to say?
Well, I just wanted to say that Susan is a perfect example of how Republicans are stating that we don't want to pay your debt, but they're not paying our debt. I just think it's really important for us to point out nobody's going to pay our debt. Maybe nobody any longer is going to profit off of our losses. Maybe that's a better way to put it, you know. And Susan has paid her debt. Now she's going on paying it twice. So it's really unfair that they create these narratives that people who don't know anything about student loan debt believe that aren't true. And I'm really glad, Susan.
And that not everyone that went to an Ivy League school is rich.
Yeah.
Again, I went to an Ivy League school and never cracked 40K until I was well into my 40s.
Right. And I'm just now making 60,000. I've made 20,000 my entire adult life. 20,000 or less. It was the same amount that I made when I got out of college. And it's circumstances, too. And it wasn't because I was a loser. It wasn't because I wasn't applying myself. The one last thing I wanted to ask is, what did Dave's son, what did he study?
Yeah, what did he study?
He studied public health. So he is a health inspector for a county in New Jersey. And he inspects restaurants and health facilities and garbage dumps and all sorts of stuff. He loves
really important work. Really important.
And he's federally registered now, so he is set for life. So, like I said, the last thing I'm going to do now is saddle him with debt. Last thing I'm going to do, I will die before that happens.
Right, and I like the point that Susan made about how in her 20s she didn't think about her debt, and it wasn't that she was being irresponsible; she wasn't making enough to consider them. I love when people talk about budgeting and they're like, put your money over here and save 20% of your income over here. And it's like, if you don't have 2 cents to rub together, these are not concepts that you can entertain. And honestly, Susan, when you said that about not thinking about it, I think that's what I did too. I knew they were there. I wanted to pay them back. I'm a responsible citizen, but I just didn't have enough money. And I also didn't know what path I was taking once I graduated from graduate school. And so I just kind of was trying to figure it out. And so they just sat there.
And then when I could make a regular payment,
right.
I did.
Right. Me too. Actually, me too. Got my first big girl job. I was so excited. And I called the servicer and I consolidated my loans and I was like, okay, I can deal with this now.
They still had to call me to get me to do it, but
Well, for me, I got on Dave's favorite, an income-driven repayment plan, right? And I paid for a couple of months, and then I got a statement, and I saw that the balance was increasing instead of decreasing. And I was like, wait a minute. Like, I've done my part. I've consolidated like 14 loans into one. I'm making payments now. I can afford to make the payments. And you're telling me the balance is going up and not going down? What is that? I'm sure in court they could tell me we told you it was on some paperwork.
I asked them why isn't my $565 a month, why isn't any of it going to the principal? Every single cent is going to the interest. And they said, I asked them this several times, like point blank, and they said, that's just the way your loan is set up. That's not an answer, but no, thank you. Not.
And I'm telling you right now, if somebody explicitly told me, hey, this payment plan that we have you on is not going to cover interest and your balance is going to increase, I would have responded a little bit more strategically. I would have found something maybe that worked. I wouldn't have just continued to do that to have the balance increase, you know?
Right. And so eventually I stopped. I said, well, then put me on the lowest payment possible. And so my $565 a month payment went down to 180, and I paid that for like a couple of years, and then the pandemic hit. But I said to them, like, if you're not going to apply any of this to the principal, then I want to pay the least amount possible. And they were like, okay, how's this? Sure. Okay. You realize that this is never getting paid off, right? I'm like, okay, well, have a nice day.
Wow. And again, we're talking about someone who was teaching, someone who had to leave teaching because they couldn't afford to pay back the loan that they got. It doesn't make any sense. And this is why so many teachers are leaving, because it doesn't make any sense how we pay our teachers. Nick, I don't want to lose your point. I know you had something you wanted to say. Did you forget?
No, I just of things like there is plenty of blame to go around. And I always just want to blame like Biden, like, You did not have to do this means testing. You did not have to stop at 10 to 20K. You did not need to announce that you're doing something, wait weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and then allow for basically lawsuits and going through the courts and so on and so forth. Biden can still just flick the pen tomorrow. There are other legal authorities that he could use, the Higher Education Act of 1965. And also what he did say was legal. It's just, why didn't you just cancel the debt, just snap, just get it done, and then where are things going to come from once the debt is already canceled?
I was trying to be like nice, but now you've made me mad at him again, and you know that I'm from Delaware and I've known Biden my whole life. Now I'm pissed at him again. Thanks, Nick.
Tell us about our president, please, Susan.
So being from Delaware, obviously, I've known Biden my whole life, or he's been my senator my entire life. And just, I ended up teaching high school at his alma mater, the private Catholic school where he went to school, his children went to school. I'm friends with people who graduated with Beau and Hunter. And so this school is a huge part of his identity. And I spent 8 years basically living above the poverty line, teaching school French and not being able to fulfill any of my obligations. And that is the context that I left, because I couldn't afford to continue to teach these very wealthy kids French. And it wasn't that it was a bad job. It was a great job, but it's a great job for someone in their 20s, not someone in their mid-30s who couldn't really get ahead. So I find it just disappointing that it's kind of like a failure of imagination, that he and his administration cannot imagine that people who went to Ivy League schools need assistance, or that people who teach need assistance, or that people that teach rich kids need assistance. And it's just disappointing. And I don't really know how to see it otherwise. But when I say, like, I'm not mad at him, and we've gone further than I ever thought we could. I mean, certain senators and Congress people 6-7 years ago were talking about this, and I never thought that we would get to this point where it was so close ripping, what is it, ripping victories from the jaws of defeat or what? But we're so close. We're so close. And yet we just can't seem to get there. But then Nick, good old Nick, reminds me that we should not necessarily give this man and his administration a full pass, because all of this, the lawsuits, the legal hurdles, the challenges could have been avoided had he understood how this issue is actually structured. And maybe he was getting the wrong advice. Maybe he was getting bad advice. But again, there's more that can be done, and relatively easily. And there you go. There you go. He lives in the same house as the people filing the lawsuits.
Yeah, I mean, the president / like Department of Ed, Education Secretary has this authority, and actually you could say has multiple authorities to be able to cancel the debt. If the federal government is the holder of this, they can just poof, cancel it. But there is, like, realistically this good legal backing behind it. But then additionally too, right, did Biden have bad advice, or who were the people around him? I mean, it all goes, I would say, to just the system. Like, it's not even, because you can look who started the payment pause, Trump, and Biden ended up continuing it. And really, it can just depend on what are, I think, sometimes those pressures. Are there people who are taking the time, like yourselves and others, to really come together as a collective to fight back against this and really put that pressure on there to say, no, this payment pause shouldn't end? Because how many times did we have the payment pause just extend? But they said, this is the final one. No, this is the final one. No, it's because of pressure. It's because of people actually coming together, sharing their stories. It realistically is this collective movement. And people, as you rightly said, Susan, a lot earlier in the podcast, that you are not alone, because you're not. There's so many people out there, 44 million or so debtors, like with $1.7 trillion in student debt. Like, that's absurd. And you're not alone. And you're also not the loan that you have, whether it's a Parent PLUS loan that the Department of Ed is saying, well, no, we're just going to forget about you. Or it's whatever federal loan, or it's maybe even a private student loan. Like, no, we don't want to leave anyone behind when it comes to that, because no one should be left behind when it comes to an education, when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to housing. Like, no. And just like to Biden, no, we don't want 10K, want 20K, go all the way. If you can cancel 10K, 20K, you can just do it all. And that's exactly what he should do. I don't care who is around him or whatnot. It's not going to be necessarily of, you know, Biden being in the office that, you know, he's going to be the one, yep, I'm going to do it. Because I don't know, I don't remember him talking about debt cancellation when he was vice president. He only talked about it because we were talking about it. Debtors. Like, that is what makes the movement.
It's also hard to make a case that payment should resume when you haven't been receiving payments in 3 years. Like, clearly you don't need the money.
Exactly. Exactly. And they don't.
They don't. And just to insert some stats, 23% of student debt was held by people over the age of 50. And that was at the end of 2021. So I'm sure that has grown since then. And then borrowers ages 35 to 49 owe more than $620 billion in student loans. And this group of borrowers owes more than 100K. They tend to have more borrowers that owe more than 100K in student loans, which I think is fascinating. I think it speaks to, again, this point of you're not alone. There are many people over the age of 50 with student loans. There are many people over the age of 35 still holding the burden of student loans. There's two more points I wanted to make, and then I wanted to get some kind of closing commentary from you. But Susan, I think you talked about writing Biden a letter last time. Didn't you write him a letter? Am I making that up?
Oh, well, I said I wanted to, but I didn't know where to start or how to write it. I haven't joined one of the writing meetings yet because of scheduling, but it's still in my plan. But Laura did.
I started to, but I didn't send it.
Well, off of that though, I will plug to folks of the importance of writing your story or crafting your story. So the Debt Collective has helped put together some like writing workshops or writers' rooms, like whatever things into, you know.
I'm going to come soon.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, definitely. And because, you know, folks, a lot of the times, maybe they don't have, I mean, I remember just a couple of years ago, I never had written like an article or anything. And then I decided to write something in my student newspaper as a grad student, because I just felt like motivated to do so, right? And we know that there's a lot of folks, going back to kind of like the "you are not alone" phrase, that feel that they are alone and feel that shame and feel what it like is pushing them to do. But understanding that there are other people out there who are facing these very similar and real issues in their lives because of this debt, that we can come together, we can write about it, talk on really how to tell your story, how to craft like an op-ed or maybe a letter to the editor. We even have a pretty cool, I'm going to say it correctly, I think, a zine. I sometimes say it the other way.
That's correct.
Okay, awesome. But yeah, and where folks can as well take to the world, share your story, because there really is power in doing that, because a lot of the times folks will just say, well, it's just these Ivy Leaguers, they have like massive amounts of student debt, so on. Or even a stat that I know of, like, I think it's around 40% of folks who might have student debt don't even have a degree from that. It's kind of crazy when you think about it like that, but it's the reality. And especially hearing folks' stories showcases that and really shows the emotion, because otherwise we're just dealing with numbers and people can easily just erase those numbers.
And I think too, like 10 years ago, I don't remember people openly talking about their debt this way. And it's such a beautiful thing that it's, I mean, even at work, people are talking about it. We get together as a family over the holidays, people are openly talking about it. And it's great, because again, just to echo your comments, Nick, the more we talk about it, the more commonplace these conversations become, and people realize, oh yeah, like it might not affect me personally, but it's affecting my sister, my cousin, my teacher, my boss, you know what I mean? And I think those conversations are helpful, and I really appreciate you all sharing your stories, because you can literally feel, you can feel the emotion and you can feel the burden, and it just shouldn't be that way, you know?
I'm sorry I cried. I didn't want to, but it's hard to talk about.
But I think that's
hard. And I shouldn't, because I've talked to all of you so many times. I trust all of you, and it's still, it's not you. It's just that like when I start talking, like I can't, it sucks. I wish that it didn't make me cry, but it still does.
Brings up years of emotion.
That's what I was going to say. And Talia and I talked about that. Part of this is the catharsis. It is kind of moving through it and letting it go in different ways. And it's helpful. It's helpful to me because it actually reminds me every time why we do this. And it pisses me off like every time. Like I get angry again with each story, the fact that we're being treated in this way. So it's incredibly helpful to kind of keep our energy up, Susan, like you said earlier. Anything anybody wants to add? Anything anyone wanted to say that they didn't maybe get a chance to?
Yeah, So I just wanted to toss out there for folks that we are having a couple different events that are scheduled or calls, such. You can just join us on Zoom. One is a legal lay of the land. So kind of what we talked about a little bit before in terms of both what's happening with this in the Supreme Court, and also just kind of talking about like the legal framework in regards to student debt cancellation and such, giving folks kind of an update and trying to summarize a lot of things that have happened into that. That's going to be on the 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern time, 5 p.m. Pacific. And then the following week on January 25th, is our State of the Debtors Union. So that's going to be at 7:30 p.m. Eastern and then 4:30 p.m. Pacific. And that basically really providing some just general updates in regards to the Debt Collective, some great things that have happened over the past year and things to look forward to and to come in 2023. As it might have been like slightly mentioned of some things that the Debt Collective isn't just about student debt. There are other forms of debt that we are definitely very much aware of and tackling, whether that's medical debt, carceral debt, school lunch debt, these different things, and understanding that this doesn't have to and this shouldn't exist, and that we can realistically organize around these debts and push for actual change, push to get these debts canceled, push to make sure that we're not worrying about these problems again and again and again, and then we don't just rinse and repeat the same old supposed fixes and just sort of make whatever tweaks around the edges, because it shouldn't be that way with any of these things. And we will definitely be having another 50 over 50 debt strike call. Things are not scheduled as of yet, so I don't have an exact date and time. Definitely a lot of things have been in the works and a lot of stuff happening. As I think folks are aware, the Supreme Court case around student debt cancellation is going to be heard in late February. I believe it's on the 28th. I forget the exact time, but a lot of stuff happening. So just as always, check us out at the Debt Collective on Instagram or at Strike Debt on Twitter, as long as it's still around. That joke. And then just on our own website at debtcollective.org. But it's awesome. And we really want to make sure that folks just do not feel alone, because you are not alone. And just as these amazing debtors here have shared, they can't pay and they won't pay and they shouldn't, because it is just BS.
Put that on a shirt. I love it. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for being vulnerable with us and sharing your stories with us. We will keep following your stories. Come back and chat with us anytime.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
If you like this episode of Matter of Life and Debt, subscribe and share it with a friend. It really helps people discover us. Matter of Life and Debt is hosted by me, Shanna Bennett, and Talia Malay, and created by Nikki Nolan. It is produced by Emma Klauber, Nikki Nolan, Talia Malay, and Shanna Bennett. It is edited by Nikki Nolan, and social media writing is done by Talia Malay. Our theme music was created by F.A. Achman. Visit our website, matteroflifeanddebt.com, where you can listen to more episodes, access transcripts, and get additional context for the subjects you just heard about. Absolutely for free. The website again, matteroflifeanddebt.com. Thanks again for listening.